almost caused confusion and delay.
You have caused
confusion and delay.
I think you are facing prejudice.
Daisy is just the ultimate fart. Daisy is just the ultimate fart.
Your impatience has caused confusion and delay. This storm has caused confusion and delay. You are causing confusion and delay. You caused confusion and delay.
26 years old and you can't even drive? I can. Are you stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive. Been great today.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another Deepest Lore. I'm here. I'm drinking a black coffee. Now, I'm not doing that because of my my fasting, my intermittent, because I'm actually in the eight-hour window right now. I'm doing that because the milk in the lodge has probably gone off. And I haven't managed to buy any new... this is the weird thing, because I'm not having milk in my tea or coffee outside of this 8 hours. I'm just not touching the milk, so I just haven't bought any. But it does mean that this little coffee here, which would usually be a flat white, has not got milk in it. Anyway, speaking of flat whites, cows, welcome to the show. You've been in the UK and as I understand it, you have converted Hat to the white side, if you want, the milk, the silky milk of the flat white, since you've arrived. Is that true?
Absolutely, yes. We've had many a delicious flat white since I've been on the Blessed Isle, and yes, thank you for having me. I think this is my debut on the Deepest Lore, so that's interesting.
Well, it's the first time for everything.
Yeah.
Could I actually raise a counterpoint to that? I think that, you know how there would be these stories of like Christian missionaries going into the jungle in like Indonesia, yeah, and they would like convert the natives to Christianity. Then as soon as the missionaries left, the natives just sort of went back to doing whatever it was they were doing before. Yes. I think that's the situation with the flat whites, because I just coffee as a whole just doesn't really have that much appeal to me.
You think you're gonna flip back, Kat?
I'm probably going to have all these flat whites, you know, while, you know, like hanging out with UAA and while Cows is here. And then the minute that she goes back, it's just going to be straight back to just cups of tea, basically all the time.
See that, Cows? Civilization is incommunicable. You cannot teach a man
there
like
you go.
Flat whites.
I will remain indigent, you know, as
the purification of coffee.
Do you ever read that?
As Carlisle would have said.
Do you ever read that? Do you ever read that postmodern novel, Foe? Do you ever read that? It's like a kind of sequel to Robinson Crusoe. And
I don't think so.
In it, Robinson Crusoe tries to teach Friday how to write. And like Friday is just like, he can't, like he won't do it. He'll just do like endless looping circles. Like, that's you basically, Hat, with the flat whites. You're just refusing.
Can't drink the reverting flat white.
You're basically Caliban. You know,
yes.
You know, teach you language, and all you use it for is to curse us.
Yeah, or endless cups of weak red bush. That's just.
Anyway, welcome Hat, welcome Cows, and Alexander Adams. Welcome back to Deepest Lore, sir.
Thank you very much. I'm here with my the cheapest brand of instant coffee possible. We do have nice coffee, but I save some of that for Amy, so because she appreciates it more than
has Amy converted you to the ways of the flat white supremacy? Yeah?
She has. She regularly twists my arm to will you buy me a coffee when we go into town? So I buy her a coffee when we go into town together.
Yeah. I forgot she was basically a version of Cheryl Cole.
no comment.
But speaking of coffee, we will start the review in a moment. I currently have these coffee bags I'm trying out. I saw them somewhere, and because I knew I was going to be having black coffees, I thought I would, you know, try something different. And it even says on them that the quickest way, the easiest way to have proper coffee. They're a bit watery for my taste, to be honest. You're meant to like brew them for 2 minutes, but Yeah, I'm not sure if I recommend the coffee bag. Anyway, anything you would like to promote, Alexander Adams?
Well, thank you for asking. No shortage of things for me to promote. I'll just stick to two things. First thing is that you can buy my books. My most recent book is Blood, Soil, Paint, published by Imperium Press, friend of the channel. So you can buy that on their website, or you can buy that on any book selling website. Also, if you'd like to read more by me, you can go to alexanderadamsart.substack.com. There you can read my articles on culture, literature, poetry, mainly the visual arts, and I usually apply a bit of an elite theory spin to some of the articles. If you like the content and you want to help me out, then becoming a paid subscriber is a brilliant way to put some money in my pocket and to support me.
Pat, anything you'd like to promote?
Well, I will be appearing on Mr. Nathan CJ Hood's channel tonight, where I'll be talking about Richard Wagner, specifically Wagner's idea of basically total art, or basically the mixture of all the different forms of art, you know, the visuals, music, sort of poetry, etc. I think about between 8 and 9 UK time tonight. So watch out for that. And I do have some things coming up, but I won't promote them now because I don't have a fixed date for them yet. But, you know, probably the next couple of months or so.
Kat, is there anything you'd like to mention?
I've been in a bit of conversation with our beloved A. Walrus about possibly appearing on his channel in the near future to talk about the European and American divide that we see here among sensible centrists. So nothing is on the books yet, but that should be coming in the near future. So if that's interesting to you, feel free to look out for that.
And you're kind of traitor to the American Patriots, aren't you, guys?
Yeah, apparently.
you kind of share some of my misgivings about the inevitable collapse of America and
absolutely
McDonald's,
and it's a good thing, you know.
Yeah, Twitter has been a bit spicy these past few days. If you want to lurk in any of the threads that are on my account, feel free to do that.
So I should mention, by the way, courses are available. I actually updated the academic agency last night and finally added the About Me page. I also have, let me show it to you. In the About Me page, I had to pick a like an image, so it just wasn't like a blank background. And I just picked an old shot of me in a hat, looking a little bit like a kind of, you know, if I was ever to release like an album of like acoustic covers or something, it would be this picture. Unfortunately, on the version I've got, you can only just see the top of my head there. But there you go, you can see. As promised, I just went for it with my, you know, I was just like, you can have the full Turley Shill credentialism on there, so people can read that in their own time. But if you do want to buy courses at the academic agency, I even mentioned the McDonald scholarship code. I did not mention my natural carving motion, which a butcher of 60 years said that I had when I was making pork sandwiches at Ascot Racecourse. That's one of the proudest moments of my life. Anyway, if you want to buy courses there, there's still about a week left. In fact, exactly a week left for the Mario Law sale. This will be the last time courses are on sale until probably August. So, you know, get them while stocks last.
Super Mario Brothers.
Game Watch. It's a demo Game Watch. Super demo Game Watch. Tell the demo Game Watch. Game Watch.
Judge, ball, burning, fire. マイクロコンピューターを使ったゲームウォッチ。ゲームをしないときはデジタル式高圧時計です。ゲームウォッ
チ。 So there we go. Also, join the Substack. I'm about to put up an article in which I do that rarest of things. I actually disagree with a take from Mike from Imperium. and it's going to be an interesting little exercise. I'm sure everybody will disagree with me because Mike is usually right, but it's an interesting piece about what is the true entropic force. Is it liberalism and wokeism and, you know, transgender ideology, or is it democracy after all, as per Hans Herman Hoppe and Carlyle and so on? And I argue that ultimately it's democracy. So as against a lot of takes that are going around at the moment. So people may be interested in that. However, we are not here to talk about things getting worse, because things can only get better. because we all went last Thursday.
Yes.
We all went to London. I met Hat and Cows and Pharaoh and various other people at a cigar shop. In fact, we went for coffee. We had some flat whites, didn't we?
Yeah, it was the Davidoff shop on German Street, which people will, I think, be quite familiar with. It's quite a famous one.
And then we went to James J. Fox.
Which
is the older cigar shop in London.
And you were resplendent in your dad clothes. You know,
I was wearing
Zelensky jumper.
I was wearing Zelensky jumper. I was wearing the Zelenskys, right? Which are. What was that Zoomer term that was going around, Cows? We can't actually repeat it on air. You know, that term, it involves the C word, I've just realized.
You're giving.
Yeah, yes.
Giving C word.
Giving C word, apparently, which is new Zoomer lingo. I mean, you know, to the extent that Zelensky is one of those, maybe. But anyway, we met up. We had two cigars, which was too many. I had two cigars.
Too many for you. Yeah.
I took about 3 hours to drink one pint, which is usual for me. what did we do? Alexander Adams came. We ended up. We went to Shake Shack and ate it in front of a white guy boomboxing in Leicester Square.
It was a real experience of the. Of what you call the derelict, you know, just
it was something truly like ashes of civilization type.
It was not a hellscape, is what.
Well, we should mention that we also met up with Pharaoh, who kind of was sort of like, because this was originally it was his idea to get everyone down to see this mm-hmm. See the play, and he basically he took us down to Leicester Square. And insisted that we get Goislop. He was kind of saying all that, you know, we're here to see a musical about Tony Blair. You know, this whole bit in kind of Leicester Square was, I think, definitely one of the kind of cultural epicenters of that era. You know, it was where like the XFM headquarters were. It was where, you know, a lot of the kind of Blair era stuff. Around that bit of London.
Skin had to jump out, you know, three lions on a shirt.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it was where the big it was where the big Iraq war protests ended up congregating in the end. You know, so yeah, we looked around. We spent ages waffling and vacillating like a bunch of women, and then we made the executive decision to go into Shake Shack, which, yes. As you say, we did. Yeah.
Simon he did Roberts treat us there. To some macaroons beforehand, though.
Oh, yes. We did go to that nice macaroon shop in Burlington.
Simon Roberts was there.
Was yeah, Simon Roberts.
Looks a little bit different from his avatar, but, you know, still a cool guy. I'm trying to remember what else happened. And then we all went to watch Tony at the Leicester Square Theatre, which is actually a theatre I've been to many times, because I used to watch Richard Herring and Stuart Lee gigs there when I was working. I actually used to work down that way, near Piccadilly Leicester Square area. So I was there a lot. So it was really easy for me to catch shows and things like that. Just, you know, I just stay behind after work. I have to say, before we talk about the musical, I thought Bond Street and the whole strip down there up towards Oxford Street was looking really good. It was obviously in the aftermath of the King's coronation and the flags were out, and I actually thought it was looking in pretty good shape, all things considered. Last time I went down there, it was looking a bit worse for wear, but seems to have scrubbed up post-COVID. So,
I mean, yeah, I think, as you say, I mean, the immediate aftermath of the coronation, essentially, because I was there exactly a year ago, almost exactly to the day a year ago. And all of those flags that hang over the streets were the weird tranny flags.
The evil pride
yeah.
flags.
Yeah, they were all over the place. So yeah, it did look better. But you know, I think as we discussed quite a few times, the big problem with anywhere nice like that in London is just you can tell it wasn't meant for this many people. Mm-hmm. there are just too many people. Basically, that's the number one problem.
There was also, because I hadn't been into London for a while. Let's just say, especially not to that part, that specific area that we were in outside Leicester Square. And I mean, Simon Roberts was saying that he just couldn't believe the kind of like almost aggressive ugliness in the faces of some of the people. He was just like. I'm not talking about necessarily the number of people, though there were a lot of people, but just the look on their faces. You know, he was saying like at least like 10 years ago there'd be like one fit one on one kind of less fit one, but
oh yeah,
now they're just like both aggressively kind of, you know, unattractive.
Mm-hmm. I mean, ugly societies produce ugly people in a kind of chicken egg style thing, don't they? It just goes round and round and round. You know.
So. That was very difficult not to notice. Although I should mention that most of the people in that area are tourists. Don't forget. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually noticed because we stayed in London for the more or less the whole week, Cows and I, and I noticed that huge amount of Portuguese people around. I don't know why. I like normally you just hear like, you know, some Nigerian language or Arabic or something, but like. Everywhere I went, I was just hearing extremely loud Portuguese. So I don't know if anyone in chat who is from there or something can like confirm if everyone in Portugal is on holiday right now. They went to London or something.
I did briefly look into, because you know I have an interest in Salazar.
Yes.
As one of the kind of, I mean, one of my favorite stats ever is Salazar's electoral history.
Yeah.
You know, literally like 12 straight elections of 100% of votes for himself.
Mm-hmm.
Based post Salazar, Portugal really went through it. I think they had what do they call it, the lavender revolution or something. They had like a proper
carnation revolution.
The carnation revolution, that's it. And my understanding is that Portugal has been a bit of a shithole for a number of years now.
Yeah,
due to not only hardcore socialism but a complete breakdown of marriage. When I was having a look at the stats, because I looked into stats because I was expecting to see that the so-called Anglo nations would have much worse marriage and divorce rates than places, Catholic countries like Spain and Portugal. But in fact, it's the opposite. Portugal, for a period, had a close to 100% divorce rate, i.e. a one-to-one, like one marriage for one divorce. I mean, something's gone seriously wrong in Portugal. And the same is happening in Spain, actually. I think they have a 80% divorce rate in Spain. So something's gone wrong in both of those countries.
Terrible. Yeah.
Anyway, we're not here to talk about Portugal either. We're here to talk about the glory years. lots of people thought, Alexander Adams, that I was making up the idea that there was a musical based on Tony Blair. They thought it was a meme. They thought I was joking. You've already written a review of this for Lotus Eaters, which I have put in the show notes. But just for people who were not able to make it, how would you just very quickly kind of give a quick kind of synopsis? What is Tony, the Tony Blair rock opera? What happens in it?
Well, it's first of all, we should mention that it's written by Harry Hill. Famous television comedian, well known from the 1990s onwards. So he lived through this and he was performing through this. So he's, you know, he had his finger on the pulse, as it were, from Blair's early years all the way through up till now. The music and lyrics, I believe, were written by someone called Steve Brown, who's a professional lyricist and composer. And this was due to open just before the pandemic, but the pandemic pushed everything back. Now, interesting, it's not, you shouldn't confuse this with something else, because there was a Tony Blair musical where Tony Blair was a sort of disaffected punk, sort of punk rocker. And that was produced in 2007. But this is a completely, this completely different book, different performers, different story. So we went in there, and it's a cast of, I think they've got a list of, they've got a cast of nine who did sterling work, because they're playing multiple roles. And so we started off with sort of basically Tony Blair on his deathbed, and sort of people asking him whether he's going to confess, whether he's going to admit his sins. And we are transported back to his early years, and we dash through his childhood. People should start chiming in and let me know what they think.
Yeah, so it's fascinating that Blair has actually spawned two musicals to his name. It's probably why they had to call it the rock opera, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know you've made it if you've spawned two musicals, you know. I mean, you'd think being prime minister for 10 years would be enough, but having two musicals, you know.
Are there any Margaret Thatcher musicals?
The people love Tony. That's why there were so many musicals about him. I think the first thing to say about it is that in the way that it's written, Tony Blair is cast as a kind of Bertie Wooster come Forrest Gump type character, where he, like, stuff happens to him, really. He's not the driver of anything.
Yeah.
He kind of bumbles his way through and almost kind of always lands on his feet in that kind of... I mentioned to you in the theatre, Alexander, that he reminded me of an Ian Carmichael character in the old Terry Thomas movies. You know, those ones School for Scoundrels, or... if you've seen any of those old comedies, but the Ian Carmichael character had that kind of quality of being, you know, a little bit posh, maybe not too bright, but somehow he ends up landing on his feet and things work out for him, you know.
Almost an endearing everyman in a way. Sort of, he's not presented with having much hinterland, as it were, you know, intellectual or moral hinterland.
Yeah. A kind of slightly more Machiavellian Tim Nice But Dim, if you want to put it that way. And we zoom through Blair's. We actually watched him being born.
Yeah,
there are a few there were a few like Harry Hill surreal moments in that, I suppose. If you're familiar with Harry Hill's style of comedy, they showed some passages from Blair in university where they cast Sherry Blair as a kind of in fact, the way that you described her in the article, Tory Burgess makes an outstanding Sherry Blair, a ruthless and sexually voracious scouser with ambitions to reach for the stars. She is an ambitious Lady Macbeth to her husband's indecisive Macbeth. So they made Cherie this overt scouser, and she was kind of low-key domineering like Lady Macbeth. And in fact, I think there was reference in the lyrics to her being
There's Lady a line. Macbeth. Could I just say before we go any further, A few people I've spoke to and I've mentioned, like, oh, it's a Tony Blair musical. This isn't like a big, like, West End style musical. This isn't like when you go to see, like, the Wizard of Oz or something, you know, where it's like a huge thing with, like, you know, lots of kind of traditional conventions. It's much more kind of minimalist. You have like the band like on stage and stuff, you know.
Three piece band with
some pre-recorded effects as well, I think. But the style of musical, the style of comedy, it feels, and I think very much deliberately so, it feels more like a kind of student review type sort of thing. Like it was deliberately going for a much more kind of I don't know what the technical term would be.
It'd be a little bit more like a kind of Brechtian ensemble cast.
Yeah, that's what it felt more like. It was you know, this isn't like, I don't know, Willy Wonka or something, like in the West End, you know. This isn't that kind of musical.
I think they take advantage of the fact there's only 9 people in the cast, and they're acting as chorus, and they're also playing multiple characters, and so they come on, and so basically the changes are often just changing a wig, and they're wearing the same clothes, and it's just changing the wig, and that's fine because you do know it, and the characterizations are so broad that you instantly recognize who these people are, and you've already got the sort of the characters anyway, so they make a strength of that.
Yeah, and the Leicester Square Theatre is kind of grungy. It's kind of grungy venue, you know. It's typically, as I mentioned, like comedy shows, and I think occasionally they do certain music acts will play there and things like that. But it's not it's in the West End, but it's not on the West End, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite low key, but in a way that I felt actually worked towards what it was doing.
It's the equivalent of Off-Broadway. I forget what they call it in the Fringe, I guess, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the sort of show that they might play in Edinburgh as well.
We actually saw posters for it in the main theater here in Cardiff as well. So it is touring around quite a bit.
So anyway, that we do get some glimpses of Blair's university years. And we were introduced to Gordon Brown, who's this, you know, very rotund man. And they exaggerate all of Gordon. I mean, if you know Gordon Brown, he does that funny thing with his mouth.
Yeah.
It's almost like custom made for large kind of parody of this sort, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a funny little joke about Blair taking the top bunk. For only for a period of time, and then he'll give the top bunk to Gordon.
Yeah,
I thought that was a funny joke, you know. But then what kind of surprised me is that they did linger on the Kinnock years for some time. Alexander, I don't know if you
I mentioned that in the review. It was peculiar because, I mean, it's kind of relevant to Blair's biography, but it's not essentially that important to, because they didn't really do that much on domestic politics. It's only relevant if you're interested in like Clause 4 or whatever, which doesn't really come up, you know, and the renaming and all this sort of focus group shenanigans. None of that came up in the opera at all.
Yeah.
So why dwell on the background politics?
What was interesting to me is that they spent quite a long time setting up during the Kinnock years, which led me to believe that it was going to go on to be like pretty in depth, you know, when Blair was actually in power.
Mm.
But weirdly, they kind of zoomed out as soon as Blair was in power. Weirdly, got like the kind of intra kind of Labour, kind of really small domestic disputes between like factions of the Labour Party and the Kinnock bit. They also gave, I've just remembered, Neil Kinnock an entire number to himself, which was actually really quite witty. You know, he had that famous speech, you know, "We're all right, we're all right." And he had
the Sheffield rally,
the Sheffield speech. And he literally had a whole number around "We're all right," which was actually quite a long song.
And then
they were like, "Oh, yeah, we lost after all." That was interesting that they spent so long on Kinnock. Also, possibly a little hint that this was written by people who are, broadly speaking, sympathetic to Labour. Do you think that's fair? These are not Tories, right?
The perspective of the musical is more or less like the average I think informed middle class opinion on Blair and the Labour years, really. That's the perspective, you know. And by informed, I mean like, you know, they watch the news and read a paper occasionally. Sort of that's like, you know, it follows a very conventional view.
Yeah. kind of center-left history, basically, is what we're getting.
Mm-hmm. Basically. I mean, I'm not going to jump the gun, but there's a huge focus on basically Blair's downfall being Iraq, and then it more or less ends as soon as he's left office, you know.
I should mention something. There's a guy in the chat saying Kinnock was old Labour, real Labour. Maybe that's why they emphasised it. I don't think that's true. There was actually another funny joke where they mentioned Michael Foot, and Blair was like, "Who?"
Yeah.
So that was kind of quite funny.
I think they did actually get the like sort of vicious PR spin, sort of rock star thing quite well. They did manage to get that, and as you know, the whole kind of machine that made Blair not just a politician but a kind of like national superstar personality type thing, you know.
Mm.
You know, they made it clear that he wasn't just some random politician anymore. You know, he if he wanted to succeed, he had to become a kind of, you know, he had to become something above that, which the other Labour leaders didn't have. You know?
And they showed that the two key figures behind that were Cherie Blair, who we've already mentioned, and Peter Mandelson, who plays like sort of the
Svengali,
he's almost like the master of ceremonies, because he's there, he sort of, he knows everyone, he introduces himself, obviously he's addressing the audience a lot.
He's a very traditional comic fool, constantly talking to the audience, you know. Mm-hmm. But he's basically that, he's the kind of old-fashioned pantomime relief, basically.
And there was a funny ongoing gag with the carrot and the stick, wasn't there?
Yeah.
He gave Blair a carrot and that was one of the funnier moments.
Which ended up over most of the two front rows, didn't it?
Blair was kind of like actually sucking off a carrot. But every time Blair said things that Mandelson didn't like, he'd hit him over the back of the whack him with a stick. But just to go back on Kinnock, this idea that Kinnock was old Labour, real Labour, is not quite true, and somewhat underestimates Kinnock's actual role in the history of both Labour and New Labour. Kinnock was actually the person who put away the militant tendency, as represented by Michael Foot, modernised the party, brought it to the centre. Okay, he wasn't quite as quote-unquote right as Blair was, but he did a lot of the groundwork. And potentially, he will be an interesting figure to keep in mind as we watch Keir Starmer's efforts to kind of rebuild New Labour, because I've been kind of having a little look recently, and maybe 2025 may be premature for Starmer, and it could end up that Starmer ends up being a Kinnock to a as yet unnamed heir to Blair, right?
Mm-hmm.
I do think it's unfair to say that, or you can either say it's unfair or gives him too much credit, depending on where you're coming from, to say that Kinnock was just a true blue old Labour. That's not quite true. What Kinnock had that Blair didn't have was a kind of common man touch. You know, he had the Welsh accent, and you know, he came from he's a miner's son and all that sort of stuff. So that, you know, he's got that famous speech he gives where, you know, he says that his father and his father before him never went to university, and you know, my kids can and all that. You know, in some areas that plays really well. What Blair was able to do was to kind of inherit what Kinnock did, but also give it that kind of, he could sell all of that to the middle classes as well. Whereas Kinnock, I think, by a swathe of the country, you wouldn't get people in like the home counties and, you know, around here, like Surrey and so on, voting for Kinnock. Whereas you know, they did vote for Blair. So.
Yeah, because Blair is actually sort of quite famously sort of rootless. I mean, he's technically Scottish, but he's got a received pronunciation. You couldn't tell where he's from, which, of course, I think meant that he had sort of quite broad appeal across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least there wasn't anything that people would object to.
Well, exactly. He had a way of being able to speak almost for everybody, and people would read in basically their own preferences into the kind of almost Teflon statements that you would make, you know. Mm. I mean, the famous one tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. If you're a progressive, he could be talking about racism. If you're a right winger, he could be talking about like banging people on the head with truncheons.
Yeah.
And weirdly, that was New Labour. They tried to do both at the same time.
And they more or less pulled it off, didn't they? You know.
Pretty much. Yeah. So we get past the Kinnock era and we get introduced to the major characters in the Blair cabinet. I actually thought that they made quite a big deal of Robin Cook in the overall scheme of things.
Yeah, weirdly.
I think that was set up for the famous speech, of course.
Yes, that's why. Yeah.
And Cook, I think, over-indexes in, you know, the imagination of certain people on the left.
Yeah, it's another point to make about the fact that this is kind of like the history of the Blair years, almost like from the point of view of the public memory, in that you're getting a kind of distorted version based on the memorable bits, you know, as opposed to anything else, you know, like Robin Cook wasn't the most important, but very, very memorable, you know, even if he's just sort of remembered for having the beard and sort of dying unexpectedly, you know, and opposing the war.
Yeah, his resignation speech is a symbolic kind of, you know, it was meant to be.
And that's, yeah. We shouldn't really go into it too much, but I think it's actually, there's a word for word extract of what he said, isn't it? It's just one sentence from his resignation thing, just played completely straight.
Yeah.
What was interesting when they were introducing each of the characters, in fact, I thought one of the better observed and funnier moments in the whole thing was Gordon Brown had this long, dreary number called macroeconomics. where he really was kind of laying out his vision for his kind of third way macroeconomics, and Blair's just like bored, doesn't know what he's talking about.
Bear in mind, this is Brown doing it with his trousers around his ankles as well.
Yeah, but they really painted it that like Brown had the substance, whereas Blair was just a bit kind of. He was just for appearances, really, and didn't really stand for anything. And to Alexander's point, I think that is the public perception that a lot of people had, especially on the left. You know, the wisdom on the left was that Brown was the economics nerd and the politics nerd and the history nerd. He really had the core of the ideas, whereas Blair was just about spin. Blair was just spin and had no basic ideas of his own, and they kind of lent into that. Personally, you know, not just as a Tony Blair fanboy, but I think it kind of sells Blair, actual Blair, a little bit short. I think Blair did have his own ideas, which are really quite clear if you listen to what he says and see the sorts of things he wrote. Blair, I think, genuinely has always believed that Labour are incapable of winning on left-wing ideas, basically. So his strategy has always been say conservative stuff to get into power, basically.
Well, I mean, I think Blair's core idea has always just been power. You know, I mean, do you remember a while back you were wondering if Blair might try and come back as a Tory AA, because you know, just any path to power, you know.
Yeah, I think it's Mandelson or I think it's Blair in the play. They actually make this point at one point. They say, well, like, it's all well and good, but we need to have power to do anything, basically. And they have this basically like Machiavellian number to argue for why it should be Blair. And then they stage like an actual wrestling match, I seem to recall, between Blair and Brown for who should be the leader. And obviously Blair wins.
This is actually a bit of the history I wasn't aware of, but they make reference to, so the wrestling match is meant to be a symbolic version of a dinner which happened in which Blair completely upstaged Brown, but I'm not sure what that is. So,
but no, that was the Granita meeting, which I think was organized by Mandelson. It's basically, they knew that So John Smith, he someone's mentioned in the chat. John Smith is mentioned very briefly. He appears.
He shows up and dies.
Yeah, because yeah. I mean, he was only in position for about a year or something. So he turns up and then he disappears very quickly. And then they knew that they had Tony Blair, who was, you know, a hot young sort of buck, as it were, in the running. And then but they had Gordon Brown, who was the deputy of Smith, and he was sort of tipped to be the next leader. But they went, but the people behind the scenes, as it were, went for Blair because they thought he was more appealing and he'd be a better face. He'd be a better sort of campaigner and so forth. And in that respect, they were correct. But they what they did was they arranged a meeting at a very fancy restaurant in Islington called Granita. And that was in 94 or something. So it was just after Smith's death. And there was going to be a contest, which I'm not sure if there actually was a contest in the end or not, or whether Blair went straight in. But anyway, Brown and Blair discussed it. And this was where the famous meeting where Blair said, OK, we're going to be a team. You're going to be Chancellor. You're going to get to do your macroeconomic stuff, yawn. And I will get to be the top guy. But we'll swap over. No, but I'll step down and then you can take over. I promise. Trust me. And that's when Brown stood aside and allowed Blair sort of pretty much a free run at getting the leadership of the Labour Party, which was in opposition at the time.
Yes. And then famously they made a deal, didn't they? And then basically we kind of speed up pretty quickly and they introduced Princess Diana as a major character in the play, which is unusual.
Well, it sort of, but you remember he was elected in May 97 and she died in the last day of August 97. So basically it was the first big thing that happened during his premiership.
But it was a perfectly timed political coup for him, wasn't it? I mean,
Mandelson points out.
That famous footage of him and his family sort of, you know, getting out of the car and he sort of, you know, sort of tells them, you know, go in, and then stands there and gives the. And I think they actually use the address that he gave, don't they? More or less.
Yes, and there's this brief moment where somebody voices ethical concerns about using the death of Princess Diana for political capital, and then they quickly knock that on the head. And it's actually one of the better moments in the play, arguably.
No, this is perfect.
Yeah,
they use that kind of wide appeal speech that you were all touching on to, you know, use like nice sounding phrases like the people's princess and that kind of thing in order to garner support for him in like him acting sympathetic about what happened.
Then this is how the abolition of Britain by Peter Hitchens starts, with the death of Princess Diana and the coming of Blair to power, which he sees as the kind of symbolic death of the old Britain. I mean, it is worth remembering what a massive deal the death of Princess Diana was. Some people may not have been born on this call,
I think that it's interesting given how basically, judging by this rock opera, all of the sentimentality around Diana is now completely dead, because some of the jokes they were doing would have caused a riot like 10, 15 years ago. They would have been like an actual riot in the theater, you know, if they tried to do some of this stuff. It was quite funny because they had an actress of clearly Asian descent playing Princess Di, I think deliberately, it seemed, which, to be honest, just kind of made it funnier. It was basically just a Chinese woman in a wig, like, you know, doing like the voice and all the Diana kind of lines and stuff.
She was pretty good, actually.
Yeah, well, it was quite.
Yeah, the impression was good.
I think you've swapped it over. I think it's Sally Cheng was Robin Cook, and she's like the most diminutive member of the cast. So she was this tiny little leprechaun with a sort of ginger wig and ginger beard, which made her appearance quite funny. The person who played Princess Diana was someone called Emma J. Thomas. I think she's
thought she was black.
Black or, I think, yeah. Or sort of.
Oh, right. Okay. Mixed race or something. I thought she looked very Asian. Yeah. Demographic.
She was good. Well, she was good nonetheless.
Yeah. It was quite a good performance.
Actually. Oh, yes. We should mention the casting. I think the casting was all around very good. So we should say who there was. There was Tony Blair, played by Jack Whittle, who I thought was quite good. I mean, he was good, especially for the younger things, because he's in his 20s, I think. So he's very good at doing the young Blair.
Could I just say on him, it's ironic given his name as well, but he is basically just doing the Jack Whitehall thing, but with a lot more talent than Jack Whitehall, basically.
Yeah.
I honestly got the impression that he's basically, as I said, the Jack Whitehall shtick, but just far less annoying and more talented than Jack Whitehall.
I'll tell you something. I in the wee hours of last night, instead of sleeping, I watched a 6-year-old interview between Alistair Campbell and Tony Blair, which I may review at some later date, because it's an amazing interview. But so good was this guy's performance that retrospectively I was thinking, I'm recognizing the character that he played in real life Blair like in that interview, which is probably the mark of a pretty well observed performance, right?
Oh yeah.
Kind of little subtle mannerisms and speech patterns and so on. He did it really well. So
well, I think we've talked about this on your channel quite a few times before, but the rule of thumb I always use is Anthony Hopkins versus Meryl Streep. Right. So Anthony Hopkins played Nixon, right? Anthony Hopkins doesn't look like Nixon, doesn't sound like Nixon or resemble him in any physical way, but he nailed something about the character so well that you completely believe it for the whole film. You believe that he is Richard Nixon. Now, Meryl Streep played Margaret Thatcher in The Iron Lady, looked exactly like Thatcher. Sounded like Thatcher, had the hair and the clothes and everything. Completely doesn't work, because she didn't get anything actually, you know, she didn't get any of the personality and any of the actual deeper traits. She was basically just a spitting image puppet. And
the essence wasn't there.
The essence isn't there, exactly. And I think that the guy that played Blair in this, which, you know, I understand that this is a goofy rock opera, you know, it's not like a serious drama. Nevertheless, I actually thought the Blair, as you say, the it was quite a studied take on Blair, basically, especially like a young
the
Blair.
Mannerisms, the smile, the yeah.
the voice in particular was almost like quite eerie. Yeah.
The one thing that happens in that Campbell Blair interview I watched last night is that because Campbell is mates with Blair, he can take kind of liberties that no other interviewer would dare to take with Blair these days, right? If you ever watch any other Blair interview, they're all softball, whereas Campbell's prepared to wind him up a little bit. And so there are several times where Campbell just won't let something go and Blair gets irritated and he's a little bit under pressure and he's a little bit kind of defensive in the interview. And there's a whole part of the rock opera where Blair is kind of justifying himself and kind of irritated. And in retrospect, he really nailed that part as well, because irritated, self-justifying Blair is a very particular thing, and he got that right. He got that very right as well. So
let's talk about the real questions.
Well, he kind of does this kind of little smile and kind of wiggle of his eyebrows as if to say, like, fucking ask me this again, you know. But he does it in such a way where he doesn't kind of belie the fact that he's that irritated, but there's a kind of passive aggression to it. And I mean, in many ways, the kind of closing number, which we'll talk about later, is a very passive aggressive song in some ways. So anyway, not to kind of go through every single little detail here, but one of the things that we all, because we kind of did a debrief afterwards in the pub, one of the things that we all kind of agreed to is that there was this kind of weird thing that they were doing with the play, was the rock opera, where they weren't trying to exonerate Blair, but all of the bad things really were pinned on other people. Cherie, Mandelson, even Princess Diana at one point, later on, and Alistair Campbell. They kind of pinned all the bad stuff on other people. And Blair remains this kind of lovable everyman, kind of that Teflon quality that real life Blair has as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like they weren't really blaming Blair. They were blaming like the people around Blair for what happened.
Well, like we were saying before, it was almost as if they like they painted him in such a way that things just kind of happened to him. So I don't know if they were trying to use that to sort of, you know, default the blame to other characters that they had in the play. So
for example, in the first half, all of the Machiavellian realpolitik stuff comes from Cherie and from Mandelson.
Mm-hmm.
They are the source of the real politics. Whereas Blair is just along for the ride, kind of, just kind of, you know.
Yeah, and I also thought it was really interesting because I've looked at the cast of the old one, the first musical that we didn't see, and they have characters. Now, note these characters did not appear in the version we saw. John Major, William Hague, Ian Duncan Smith, and Michael Howard. There were no conservative politicians in this at all, because basically the opposition did not exist. And quite rightly, this new production says basically, no, there's no point in spending any time on them at all, because they didn't count at all.
They didn't factor in.
Yeah, and I remember Blair entirely set the entire political agenda and has continued to do so even to this day.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where we're still...
He is the Dark Lord.
We're watching a musical about him.
He was never defeated, and he was never injured by the Conservatives using any Conservative arguments. The only argument that hurt him was basically... it was basically foreign policy, wasn't it? And that wasn't really led by the Conservatives.
Well, I mean, there's that bit when he's ranting towards the end where he says, look, you're also morally impugned over the Iraq war. And you know, I'm meant to be such an evil person now. Let's not forget, you all voted me back three times with two landslides, one of which was after the Iraq War got started. So you know,
yeah, like, he saved all the foxes.
The recurring joke about the fox hunting. Yeah.
There was that moment where it was like, who voted for me? I was bursting. Me, Tony.
It was me. You're Tony Blair's top guy.
Nobody put their hand up, were they? Nobody admitted to it. Although, judging by the... I mean, we can talk about this a bit later on, but judging by the response at the end, like, I actually got the impression that probably most people in that room voted for Blair.
Oh, definitely. The ones that were old enough, you know, probably all voted Blair. Or at least they definitely didn't vote Conservative or anything else. So.
I mean, is there anything else in the first half that we've missed, or should we get to the second half?
No, I think that's pretty much all the main stuff from the first
half. The interval, am I wrong in remembering that the interval is right before he gets to power, or just after?
Just after they've done the Princess Diana stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, now pretty much has entered George W. Bush, and then it, you know, I don't know if Bush enters after.
Yeah. Well,
it's basically they say, you know, they say that the second half will be dominated by Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, played by the same guy who does Gordon Brown, and George Bush.
So we came back, you know, got some drinks. I tweeted out a picture of the Tony thing. A lot of people said, "Oh, it doesn't look very full," but I did take it in the interval because everybody was getting their drink.
It was pretty full. I would say it was sort of like
more or less
80-90% full. There was a few empty seats next to us, but then they filled up. So I guess people moved from the back to the
when I rebooked the tickets a few weeks ago, there were very few seats left. It was more or less full, I think.
Not a dry eye in the house for Tone. Not a dry eye. Everybody was touched. but anyway, as we came back, basically it was enter George W. Bush. And they did this kind of interesting thing where Bush had his own Mandelson, who was Dick Cheney.
Yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Played by the same guy.
Yeah, played by exactly... Like, they did that thing where the double... There was a double court, an old Shakespeare trick where there was a kind of mirror court in the White House that looked a lot like Blair's, mm-hmm. but it was Bush's. And, you know, it was all the old 2000s jokes, you know, Bush thick as two short planks. It was Dick Cheney and who was the other guy?
Rumsfeld.
Yeah, Rumsfeld and Cheney were the real masterminds behind the Iraq War. And basically there's a whole... We get numbers from Osama bin Laden, which, as we talked about, Hat, was pretty edgy in a way.
It was pretty edgy and also very funny.
Kill the Infidels.
Kill the Infidel. And it was that and the Saddam Hussein song. You know, I'd never done anything wrong. You know, that was very funny. But
yeah,
I mean, it was a bit frustrating because as funny as those were, I was a bit disappointed that they seemed to be giving the whole second act to, you know, Iraq. it was Iraq, it's the Middle East, you know, because
it could have gone thick, couldn't it, but we
both know that wasn't really the Blair downfall, you know? Yeah. And we also know that the whole angle they went for with Blair being Bush's kind of patsy, that wasn't really true either.
Yeah, and weirdly enough, of course, that was like the first 12 minutes or something without Blair on stage. He didn't appear on stage after
the
first 12 minutes of the second half.
I mean, to be fair, I think given how intense it was, I think the actor probably needed a break.
he was very sweaty.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a gag, wasn't it? The play about me when he came back. He was like, what about me? You know?
Yeah.
Called Tony. I will say the Saddam Hussein, the kind of fat, it was almost like a kind of Groucho Marx come like Super Mario or something. It was really funny though, especially given his heft. Both of those numbers were really funny, and I thought the Bush stuff was reasonably funny as well. Though
yes,
Bush stuff feels a bit tired to me because I lived through it all. Of course,
some of it did feel a bit like jokes that Seth MacFarlane was doing on like Family Guy in 2008. Sort of thing.
Yeah, it was all a bit kind of Bremner, Bird of Fortune, if you remember those words. But how can I put this? Well, I mean, as a point of order, they mentioned at one point there was a hint of awareness that Blair had already been to three wars before Iraq. Kosovo.
Yeah, they do mention it.
Sierra Leone
and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Which incidentally, Alistair Campbell also brought up in that interview I watched last night as well. But what was missing is that basically Blair goes to the White House and is talked into, again, swept up with the flow of bombing the shit out of everybody, basically. Mm-hmm. George Bush has just got this song about like bombing shit. And I
have to say, it is genuinely very entertaining. Like I was really having a fun time with that stuff. You know,
it was fun.
Yeah,
but I mean, and it is the normie perception of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But as I mentioned on Twitter afterwards, I remember reading an essay called by Christopher Hitchens, not Peter Hitchens, Christopher Hitchens, called "Tony Blair Neocon" or "Tony Blair Neoconservative," which basically outlined how actually it was Blair who really believed in doing this sort of stuff, mm-hmm. talked Bush into the weapons of mass destruction idea, talked Bush into the importance of selling it to the rest of the, you know, what do they call them, community of free nations or whatever, the UN and all that. Blair was the one who wanted to get the UN resolution. Blair was the one who, you know, thought... you know, whether the dossier was sexed up or not, we have to be careful because they're funny about that. They even noted that during it. Do you remember they had that legal notice where they couldn't say it because Alistair Campbell really hates being, like, he really hates being accused of the sexed up dossier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we should say, you know, the alleged sex up dossier. Well, or whatever.
There's quite literally a line where the implication is that they would say a lot more, but they literally can't because of legal reasons. Like they say, oh, well, the legal team of the Leicester Square Theatre prevents us from saying more.
They're actually funny about this. They're even doing that interview. Blair says there were six separate inquiries. The Mafia investigated the Mafia six separate times, ladies and gentlemen, and found the Mafia not guilty every
single time.
Not guilty
on all counts. Yeah.
So basically the narrative is, in the play, it's the American to talk Blair into it, whereas in actual fact, Blair was more instrumental in pushing this agenda than people giving credit for.
Just out of curiosity, then, was Christopher Hitchens writing that as a, given his support of the wars in the Middle East, was he writing that as a pro Blair piece?
I'd have to go back and have a look at it. But yeah, I mean, he did basically support the Iraq War.
Vociferously so.
And
he was big in favor of it.
As far as I know, he supported Blair as well. So yeah, well, it was kind of like a celebration of Blair more than a kind of.
Well, I mean, I think Christopher Hitchens was smart enough to know what Blair was about, basically, and he was like, well, this is the path to like world liberalism, you know.
Just, I mentioned before, I actually supported the Iraq War as well. And
you supported it out of contrarianism, though, didn't you?
I remember all my friends and things were going to the London March because they were giving free sandwiches out. Oh, come to the march, we'll give you a free sandwich. And I had read a neocon book by Robert Kagan called Of Paradise and Power, where he basically said, like, well, it's all well and good living in postmodern Europe, but some of us have to live in the real world of realpolitik, and in the real world, you know, you need to use power, basically. So I was again hooked on my Machiavellianism. It's been a lifelong love for that. So yeah, I kind of, for Machiavellian reasons, support the Iraq War. Although I have now come to see that those Machiavellian reasons that were sold to us were also not true. Mm. You know, back then it was all about oil and all about like, oh, our positioning in the world. But like now, 23 years later or whatever it is, none of those things happened either. It was a fucking disaster. So I think that's one of the problems they've got on that, is that even the Machiavellian argument falls down when you look at what's happened there.
Well, I think that, I mean, even among us, the jury is still somewhat out on, you know, the exact reasoning and the exact aims behind the Middle East, isn't it? You know, I think there's that famous line by Mao where some journalist in the 70s said to Mao, what do you think the impact of the French Revolution has been on the world? And Mao said, it's too early to say. Mm-hmm. You know, it's basically that, just, you know, I honestly think we're still a little bit too close to the event to conclusively say
what
was going on. You know?
Interestingly, Blair is just doubles down and triples down and quadruples down on it. And actually in that interview lays into Obama he basically says Obama's policy on Syria was just one of the worst setback, the foreign policy agenda, 50 years. Mm. He said, you cannot say we're going to get, you know, you cannot have a situation where everybody says Assad out and then Assad doesn't.
Who must go?
Assad must go, right? Assad must go.
Yeah.
He says, I mean, basically saying that makes the West look like toothless clowns. If you're going to do it, you have to fucking do it, is what Blair's view is. And his argument is that they basically didn't finish the job in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria. They needed to just do it properly. And it's interesting, he talks about the Arab Spring in a way, like he acknowledges that the Arab Spring was a kind of disaster and that there should have been, you know, remember there was that moment where like Obama and all them were celebrating about like the downfall of Gaddafi and the coming of the Arab Spring in Egypt and all of that. Yeah, Blair's argument is that all of that should have been more controlled, that it should have been like you basically cheered that on without a plan.
Well, yeah.
So his, I mean, it, you know, he's going to say that, isn't he? He's going to say, if you deviate from my plan, things go to shit. That's Blair's whole argument all the time. So anyway, pretty much they talked about the Iraq War for the rest of the... I mean, was there any non-Iraq stuff in the second half? there was a couple.
Well, there was a bit of those Blair rivalry thing that was sort of simmering. That's the sort of a light motif which runs through the
with
whole
Brown.
Play. Yeah,
there was a bit, there was a funny bit where Cherie and Brown try to smile because famously neither properly.
I did feel slightly like there was a point where they just started sort of going through the ropes of 2000s era political jokes.
Yeah. You know,
because like you have all this stuff going on with Iraq, and then randomly Cherie and Brown come out and do the Gordon Brown can't smile joke, and then it just sort of ends, you know, it goes on to the next bit.
There was nothing really domestic at all.
And then what's funny is that at one point Blair decided, right, I've had enough now, packs his bag, goes on holiday, says, Gordon, job's yours. And then immediately the economy crashes.
The phone starts ringing. I did quite like how they handled that, because there were great comedic like beats with him being like, "Yes, I got the job," and then the phone rings. He's like, "HSBC,
Lehman Brothers."
Yeah.
I mean, it is funny that Blair, in real life, went out on high, like undefeated, literally in amazing ceremony. Economy riding high, off into the sunset. That's how the Tony Blair story ends in real life. And then everything goes wrong like a minute he's out the door.
Yeah.
And that is basically the end of the show, isn't it? Oh, well, okay. Well, we got the showstopper at the end, but that's basically him leaving. That's the end of the story of the show.
Yes. And this again was something I was kind of half expecting, but was a little bit disappointing for the Blair nerd that I am, right? Which is the, you know, he left power formally in 2007. In an interview I watched last night with Campbell, his exact words were, "What you've got to understand is when you're in office, the infrastructure is all there for you already. The state lays it on for you, right? You know, you have number 10, you have all the staff, you have everything." And then he says, "When you're out of office, you have to build the infrastructure yourself, right?" And that's what he's basically spent the past, I mean, how long has it been since 2007? 15 years. Like, he spent the past 15 years building his own empire, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, two things struck me. One, when you leave power, you could just retire. You don't have to build an infrastructure. Most people don't. You know, most people just, you know, take a place in the House of Lords and play golf and occasionally do the odd TV interview or something.
And join a board of a charity or something.
And join a pile of board. Blair didn't do that. Blair literally built an international network of NGOs, which is now consolidated under the Tony Blair Institute.
And he's now technically more powerful as well than he was as Prime Minister.
Yeah, absolutely. Which backseat drives not only policy for the UK, but policy for Europe, America, and
most of the world.
25 different African nations. And Blair actually, in that interview, which I will cover at one point, is he says, oh, you know, he basically alludes to the normie view of him. He says, like, the normie view of him, I can't remember his actual phrase, it's like the stereotypical view of me, is that I left office and I went around the world making loads of money, right? And, you know, basically, where he says, what I've actually been doing is building this empire, basically. And it was interesting to me that the guys who wrote the show either weren't aware of that or deliberately chose not to complicate the story that he just leaves politics at that point.
I wanted to see more Dark Lord Blair. It was a bit disappointing when they just went back to the Blair corpse confessing his sins.
I was hopeful at the beginning because, as you say, they the entire story is framed within Blair being on his deathbed. And when he was there with, like, you know, the white wig going, Cherie, I thought, oh, great, okay, so we're going to get some stuff, you know, towards the other end of Blair's life, you know, because what's funny is that, you know, that picture that you like to use of him, AA, when he had, like, the long COVID hair,
that
kind of looked exactly like the corpse Blair in the show, with the white hair. I thought, oh, great, we're going to get some actual Dark Lord stuff, you know, but we didn't, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think one of the tensions in the play is that the reason they couldn't draw attention to current Blair and what he's been up to is that they essentially agree with him on everything.
Mm.
You know, I got the impression that they would have been anti-Brexit, right? There was a couple of... it was interesting, Alexander, you said that it was delayed and it was actually written like 2-3 years ago. I felt that a couple of the gags were dated and at one point would have got a big cheer in a London audience, but now didn't get any reaction at all, which were basically jokes where Donald Trump or Boris Johnson with a butt.
Yeah, I think those dated. There were a couple of jokes that fell a bit flat, but those ones in particular felt flat. That no, even people who don't like Trump or Johnson just are just bored with the subject. They just don't want to talk about it. It's not funny for them. They've heard the jokes already. They kind of agree that they're both beastly scallywags.
It's not worth a cheer.
But it's not. But they you know, they couldn't work up any enthusiasm for them.
But they wanted to take this line in Tony, that they're anti-populism, right?
Yes. That was one of the major criticisms that Blair had opened the door for populists.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that somehow Blair was at fault for this. But so they wanted to take aim at neocons. They wanted to take aim at elites in general, but also at populists.
Yeah.
They were also the kind of... And it was like... Can you really thread this needle of basically being Blairites without Blair? Because that's basically what they wanted to do.
Yeah.
And I wonder, I mean, now that you guys have thought about it a bit more, do they resolve this tension? Are they self-aware at all? I mean, Alexander, what did you say in your review in the end? What did you kind of conclude on?
Yeah, so I basically said that, well, Blair seems to have framed the situation so thoroughly that they couldn't escape the sort of the Blair paradigm, that they did basically agree with what he did and with his outlook, and that, yeah, you know, spreading democracy is kind of a good thing, and wouldn't it be better if, you know, women in Afghanistan were liberated like the ones in the West and so forth, and that his only problem was he'd fallen in with a bad crowd who'd led him astray with this silly war on terror business. But basically, if he'd been less manipulated, he could have been a great man.
His actual aims were good, and they agree with all of his principles, apart from the Iraq bit. So they kind of wanted to do both at the same time, and they end up with this number by Blair: the world is run by assholes. And they have this... I mean, for me, by far the weakest part of the entire thing.
Definitely.
They have this montage of all of the arseholes of the world, which includes...
From a liberal point of view.
Because basically Blair's apologia is basically, hey, I was an arsehole, but you voted for me, and hey, look at these other guys. They're just as bad, or maybe even worse.
It's really frustrating because the problem is that you could be really clever if you were writing this and deliver kind of a gut punch to the presumptions and assumptions of this kind of liberal audience, you know, which they almost, they veer on it because they go, well, you know, you all voted for me and all this kind of thing. But they never really send it home. And I think partially because it would be a very critically risky thing to do, you know, because, you know, like sort of liberals love above all things, they love feeling safe, right? They hate being challenged. If you challenge them, they'll just call it, you know, subversive, like right-wing populist rhetoric or whatever. But to be fair, I also think the writers probably aren't that self-aware. I think you said this on the night just after when we were in the pub. You said that when they were doing, you know, the whole world is run by asshole song, they ran it through with a kind of like, you know, basically a load of right-wing populists and then Lenin and Stalin, you know.
Yeah, there was like, they had Erdogan, Assad. Yeah.
Bolsonaro.
Bolsonaro.
Kim Jong-un.
Xi Jinping.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ultimate arsehole was Putin, which didn't get any sort of like... I cheer or whoop.
It got a little bit of a sort of
a little bit
chuckle. Yeah,
clapped her You know, sort of in sort yeah, of instead of real more. A real laughter, it was sort of clapping approval.
Probably didn't yes. have the intended effect, did it?
See, I predict because the delay of this the show coming out, they kind of led in with some of the anti-Trump stuff. I think if the play had come out when it was supposed to, do you think that the big picture at the end would have been Putin, or do you think it was supposed to be originally written as Trump?
Probably the big Trump. Picture at the end? Yeah.
Ooh, yeah, that's a good call.
Putin wouldn't really have worked in like then. 2020. The audience,
the devil that he became after the beginning of the war. Yeah.
The audience would have been confused, basically, if it had been Putin.
I will say though, there were very few anti-Brexit jokes in there. There was a couple of like one line on Boris, really, but they didn't really, and they didn't have a picture of Boris.
Well, I thought that I got a bit excited during the song because I thought the joke they were going for was that you'd have like, you know, all these like, you know, basically heels that you're showing to the audience, and then you just do like Rishi Sunak at the end.
Yeah.
Like, I thought, and I thought it would have been good because it would have been an almost kind of like a subversive joke. But they didn't, and I thought. But the thing is, it's a missed opportunity because the easiest joke to ever do in a country like Britain is just have current prime minister in a list of like evil people. Like that is a guaranteed laugh every time.
They didn't have any Western leader, period, apart from arguably Bolsonaro, who's not even the president of Brazil anymore.
Yeah.
There wasn't. They could have put Macron. They could have put. They didn't put Maloney. They didn't put Biden. They didn't.
Can you imagine if they put Zelensky? Can you imagine?
which to me is like disappointingly playing it safe.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, they could have made more of a thought-provoking bit if they'd included everybody. I mean, imagine if they put Barack Obama on there or something like that. You know, it just could have been like they could have made a almost kind of Robert Michel's Iron Law of Oligarchy point. But they didn't. Yeah. They pulled back and just weasel.
Well, it's minute. You're right that it's very weaselly because if the main hook of the song is the whole wide world is run by assholes, and yet as you say, they've got like Pol Pot. But you know, if you were going to take that to its obvious conclusion, you know, as you say, where's Obama? Where's Biden? Where's Macron? You know, you should. You know, if you're going to make the audience laugh at that line, any kind of, you know, lyricist, artist, whatever, surely has the urge to push it, you know, to push the audience and see what they do. You know, it seems obvious.
Disappointing political quietism from Harry Hill.
Yes. Come on, Harry Hill.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So I thought that was the weakest part by a mile. It could have been good. That last bit, but I felt that they chose really safe targets, and in the end, basically, Blair says, "What if I said I'm sorry? How about that?
Would you let me back?
Would you let me back?"
And I think they would.
New Labour too.
But they absolutely would. I mean, they basically are. You know, it doesn't matter.
And I did notice people like whooping and cheering at the end, like taking selfies themselves and so on. So there was a bit like a smattering of standing ovation for it. So.
Oh, yeah. There was quite a lot of standing ovation, actually. Yeah,
about half the audience stood up. I think, to be fair, I think it was more because it was a very entertaining show as opposed to like, yay, liberal politics, you know.
And also that it was coming to the end of its London run. So there were obviously some friends and family or visitors who were coming back to sort of say farewell to that.
I have to say, I was not able to get a read on the politics of the crowd, though. I mean, at one point you would have said, well, we're in London, they're going to be liberals. But I didn't really get I find it really hard to get a read of the public at the minute.
It was
odd. There's a very diverse bunch of people attending the show. I mean, everyone was mostly white, but it was all sorts of different age groups. There was like a group of like Zoomer looking like hippies that came in. There was more like a uni type, you know, a group of boys. There was old people, like boomers. There was elderly people.
Yeah, there's some guys in suits who'd come from office jobs and they were in their
30s.
To be fair, I think the problem is that at this specific moment in time, AA, yes, most people just, you know, are conditioned to agree with, like, you know, broadly liberal kind of Blairite progressive points. But I think if you had to try and sum up the politics of the average normie in the audience, if they probably just chime with that "the whole world is run by assholes" song. I think there's probably just a level of cynicism that just they're just, well, yeah, you know, I mean, because the average normie has been conditioned to hate, you know, whatever, you know, Trump, Boris, Tories, you know, all that kind of thing. Starmer is trying to be Blair 2.0, but he hasn't got anywhere near it yet. So there isn't, it's not like there's really a clear stance the audience could have taken. I mean, I think essentially it was probably written as a vehicle with far more like anti-Trump, anti-Boris jokes that, because of the delay in staging, had to be taken out. But those weren't really replaced with anything. You know, it just became a bit more broad in its kind of political attacks. You know, well, you know, all the politicians are bad, you know, type thing.
Yes. You know, it's funny, on the actual official site, it says, "Please note, neither Tony Blair, the Tony Blair Institute, nor any other person featured in this production have endorsed the production or the marketing material, are in no way affiliated with its production."
Well, I mean,
Tony is still touring. It is still going around the country. It's actually in Guildford from tomorrow. It's in Guildford until the 3rd. Then it goes to Birmingham, then Cardiff, then Richmond. So you can actually go and see it multiple times. I mean, I could go to Guildford really easily from here. You guys could go to Cardiff easily.
Yeah, let's go again. Yeah.
and Richmond's just down the road from me as well. So, you know, I could go and see it 3 times if I wanted to. But I won't. Carry on, sorry.
Well, I mean, I think that's more or less the problem with the kind of the, as I said, it's the specific era we're in, where, I mean, we've been talking about it, where the regime is kind of stuck between two places, in that, well, you know, we've conditioned everybody to hate the kind of political class, and, you know, hate this or that, and now we have to kind of do a weird Western anti-Russian patriotism to fight for Ukraine. You know, that's the paradox of this particular year, I think.
You cannot criticize neoconservatism from within the fucking paradigm of neoconservatism, which is what they were trying to do in this play. Mm-hmm. Which is just, I mean, what's the difference between the, you know, the anti-Putin stuff and the anti-Saddam stuff? It's exactly the same. And I just a tiny little bit of more self-awareness. I mean, Harry Hill's a really smart guy, so I'm a little bit surprised that there wasn't more of it. But maybe they were just thinking, well, how are we going to earn money? You know,
I think Harry Hill's primary consideration was probably just the humor for this. I mean, the political stuff and the kind of slightly edgy stuff is there, but if that was the main focus, it would have been a very different show, I think, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there was an element of it as just like the normie version of what happened, as a kind of form of like safe nostalgia.
Mm-hmm. More or less. But at the same time, it all comes down to, you're going to write a London musical, which is then going to tour. You've got to give people a good night out. You know, like you do have to balance the kind of practical considerations as well, you know. Although that being said, it would be great if we could sneak a few of our guys into, like, you know, the kind of stage scene and basically do a version of this that just like trashes all the liberal assumptions about the Blair era and see how it goes down.
I mean, I wonder if it would play differently in different parts of the country.
Yeah,
I mean, they're going to places like Derby. I mean, it's pretty rough in Derby.
Yeah,
they're going to Liverpool, which is a pretty, I'd imagine, a pretty Corbyn-y, non-Blair era.
Yeah, I wonder how they'll respond to Sherry Blair.
I was going
to
say.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting.
So that'll be interesting. I mean, hopefully enough people watch this show that we'll have agents, the academic agents all around the country watching,
reporting
Tony and reporting.
But you could also have little meetups as well.
You can make it a weave.
These could be basket weaving opportunities.
Yeah.
Because I will say that the show is overall it's amusing. The songs are pretty good. They're quite catchy. The performances are really good.
It's a solid night out.
So
it's very entertaining.
I would recommend this as a basket weaving opportunity.
Yeah. It's not the base meeting of the century where, you know, every idea that you have is being challenged. It's not what it was meant to be. As you said, it's a comedic show. It was funny. It's not overly, you know, liberal, so like a person like us wouldn't enjoy it. I was thoroughly entertained.
I mean the only actual virtue signal in the whole thing was that picture
that
of
Putin.
I mean, in terms of, they played it kind of ironically enough kind of down the center. I will say somebody on Twitter has been showing their screenshots. There was that's something we didn't mention, that his dream was to meet Mick Jagger's.
Yeah, Mick Jagger's.
Which is, again, a very Harry Hill joke. That it's Jagger's, right? It's very Harry Hill. There was the Princess Diana. There's the Robin Cook that we talked about. And this was the Mandelson, the Gordon Brown, there's Cherie and Tony.
Yeah, also we should mention that Prescott is also in it as well.
Yes, and Prescott's still around. I was looking last night to see what he's 84 years old. He is, but he still looks all right, and he's still living off the punch.
So. Still looking like Bernard Mannings.
Yeah, he did that in Rill, and yes, it was still the talk of the town a few years later when I was working in Rill. So.
Well, I mean, Prescott was an underrated part of the Blair campaign because that. New Labour had all of these kind of proper working class guys, you know, to kind of tamper the kind of middle class gayness of Blair a little bit, you know, to connect with Labour heartlands in a way. Not that Blair was not able to connect with the working man, but sometimes it, you know, just sounds better from an old union boss from Sheffield or whatever, you know.
I can't remember who it was that summed up Prescott's appeal. It may have actually been UAA, but I can't remember. But it was, I was listening to some people talking about it, and they were talking about Blair, and they were sort of arguing about why, you know, someone like Prescott. And somebody just shouted, "Prescott's appeal is that he looks like a man who eats pies."
Yes.
It's just like, yes. That basically sums it up. That's it. Like he looks like a man you'd see in like your local Wetherspoons, basically. You know.
Yeah, and that character has kind of disappeared from a lot of the cabinets now.
I think he's too unsafe. He doesn't have the sterile kind of. Everybody that gets to cabinet now, especially, I mean, in the Tories, especially, is, you know, Liz Truss. Soon out, they have to be these like sort of
unproblematic,
it's
all the PPE, then special advisor, then safe tour, then safe seat, then it's a fast track, and it's the David Cameron machine, never had work.
No,
I mean, he had a number of these. There was, Blunkett, even though he was blind, And he was a bit of a character, you know, Blunkett, and had a kind of common touch, and a very tough Home Secretary when he became, he locked a lot of people up. They brought in Stop and Search and all of that sort of stuff. Because Labour, this is my whole argument, are prepared to use power in a way the Tories are not.
Absolutely. If you went up to Prescott and called him fat, he'd probably just chin you, right? But like,
I am. What of it?
But like, think of Matt Hancock on that train getting like called out by that Indian guy or whatever.
So Weasley. They're all Matt Hancocks now.
Yeah, basically, they're all Matt Hancocks.
I mean, there were a lot of these guys. I mean, do you remember Charles Clarke? He was another big fat bruiser that they had.
Alan Johnson, who used to be a postman.
Johnson, yeah, who was a favorite of mine on This Week. Alan Johnson, if you can look up his anti-Corbyn rant on This Week, back when it was Diane Abbott and
Portillo,
Andrew Neil. It was Andrew Neil, Portillo, Diane Abbott, But for a while, Abbott had to go because Abbott was campaigning for Corbyn. They had Alan Johnson there, and Alan Johnson just fucking laid into Corbyn every single week. And he's got one epic rant where he basically just says they are just like student politics. You know, we have to get rid of this because they're juvenile and they're wrecking the party. And I remember it being a great barnstorming and of, because it's kind of weird. You get more of that kind of rolled up actual lads on in the Labour side, which is bizarre to think of now, because we tend to think of all of our politicians as being remote from us. And
Well, they are now, yes.
So anyway, that there it is. You'll get to know these characters when I do my Summer of Tone and I rewatch the 1997 election, because they'll all have a...
Can't wait.
I'll have interviews and stuff.
it's like how you look for work, I guess. Some people look forward to the summer because you get Henley, you get Wimbledon, and all this. And now on top of that, we've got the Summer of Tone. You know, great entertainment.
The true white boy summer, as Brad Lib said last night. There have been a couple of super chats before we get out of here. Nathan CJ Hood says, "Good save, our gracious Tony Blair."
By the way, just because you mentioned Mr. Hood there, I made a mistake. I implied the stream was happening later today. It's not. It's happening on Saturday. The Wagner stream I mentioned. That is this coming Saturday.
An easy mistake to make.
Not today, yeah.
Son of Haster says, "Hey, cows, I'll never forget ordering coffee with cream in the English countryside when a bewildered waiter brings me a heavy cream with my pub coffee." Benjamin Rood says, "Watch the start of Campbell interviewing Blair. You must do the stream. Campbell is loathsome. Some questions were indecent. Makes you sympathetic to Tone." Yeah, I mean, a number of people have watched it and said that they ended up hating Campbell and loving Blair by the end of it.
I mean, but sorry.
I did just remind people that Alistair Campbell's entire job, his whole life, has been to make Blair look good. So, you know, he was his spin doctor.
I mean, you mentioned, you know, how everybody in politics these days is kind of a, you know, horrid, like squeaky clean Matt Hancock type. He is a loathsome sort of toad, but I do have a sort of slight respect for Campbell because he is a bit of a bruiser type. I remember a few years ago watching an appearance he did in front of the Oxford Union where he gave a speech and then took a load of, like, you know, attack questions from the student crowd, which he just, you know, handled expertly. But his entire demeanor for that whole thing in front of all these, like, you know, like fat Asian women that attend Oxford now was just like, I'll just chin you. I will just chin you if you try anything.
He does have a brilliant kind of utter contempt. I mean, again, at 4 in the morning when I should have been sleeping, I had to capture this and put it on Twitter. This is an example of what we're talking about. Hold on.
I'm throwing out the pool. I'm throwing it out, Richard. Okay, bye-bye. Off you go.
But we're not going to go. We're going to be outside.
Well, then go outside.
There we go. Out. Just get out. Just get out, you know.
Now get out. Yeah. Can you start using that at the end of your streams?
It's fine. The sunny there. You can see Mandelson sneaking. He's like, "What's going on here? What's going on here? Is this a PR disaster waiting to happen?" You know, they were so good at the close control stuff, and there, of course, is Tone with Campbell. There was a famous interview once because Blair was under quite a lot of pressure to get rid of Campbell due to his famously abrasive style, and you know. Malcolm Tucker from Thick of It is based on Campbell, which he rejects, by the way. There's just an interview where Blair is asked, like, "Well, can you get rid of him?" And he just laughs and moves on to the next. He won't answer the question, just laughs to himself, and then, you know, moves on to the next one. So
can you get rid of your fire breathing dragon, Your Majesty? You know,
yeah, exactly. He's like that. Yeah. Absolutely no way. So. Campbell and Mandelson are two kind of ever constants. Machiavelli Sucks to Go says, "I just can't believe now that every leader is a traitor nowadays." So, yeah, I mean, it would be nice to have at least one who wasn't, you know, but, you know, here we are. Yep. All right. I will just remind people, pick up a course, Game & Watch. What is it? Promo code Mario Law.
Super Mario Brothers 2.
Alexander Adams, where can people find your stuff?
People can find me on Twitter at Adams Artist, or they can also visit my Substack, which is Alexander Adams Art, all one word, .substack.com.
Hat, you just mentioned the Hood stream, but
yeah, coming up later this week. Well, my Twitter is at Verse by Hat, and watch this space for stuff coming out this year. Should be a few things.
Cows.
My Twitter is at Cowpill, and so is my YouTube channel. More stuff will be on there fairly soon.
Yeah, no, I'll just say I'm about to publish a piece on Substack, Liberalism versus Democracy, which is the more entropic force. I'll publish that in like literally 5 minutes. So subscribe to my Substack if you're not already. I'll put the link out on my community tab soon. All right. Till next time, I'll be back on Monday. Now get out.
What goes on in this town?
I mean, maybe it should be to play us out. Where is it?
The Right Honourable Tony Blair, former Prime Minister of the UK, founder of the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. We're delighted to have...
Traveling across the seas to help save all the other countries, but the day you left, the country fell to its knees. So I say, Tony Blair, T-Man, B-L-A-I-O, you're in our hearts. I know you had to go, it doesn't stop it hurting. So I say, Tony Blair, with your gentle face, your heart of gold and strength of gods. The day you left this place, the country went to the dogs. But I know you're only one man in the world that needs fixing. If I could, I'd gather all your friends. Together we'd all pitch in. And when the world was fixed, we'd gather round the people in their millions. And we'd raise the crown to the new King Tony Blair. God save our gracious Tony Blair, long live.